Hello and welcome to a Search Storage podcast on boosting array performance. My name is Mark Lewis and I'm one of the editors of SearchStorage.com. Joining me is Ray Lucchese. This is the third of a four-part podcast series on boosting array performance. Ray Lucchese is president of Silverton Consulting. Silverton is a strategy, storage, and systems consultancy based in Colorado. Ray has worked in the data storage industry for more than 25 years. Most of his work has been in engineering and directing the development of new enterprise-class disk and tape storage products. Thanks for joining us, Ray. Lesson 3 will cover secondary performance impact. Ray has also developed a set of slides that go along with these podcasts. You can find the companion slides and the other podcasts in this series at searchstorage.com/performance. Okay, everyone, I think we're ready to turn our attention to Ray Lucchese and Podcast 3. Ray?
This is Ray Lucchese, president of Silverton Consulting. In this podcast, we discuss secondary performance drivers and limiters, including transfer size and speed, additional cache features, I/O balance, local replication, and some speed limits to subsystem performance. Transfer size is the size of the blocks transferred between the subsystem and the server. This is typically configurable and could be set as small as 512 bytes to as large as multiple megabytes. If you're doing mostly sequential I/O, the larger the better. Every sequential transfer ultimately causes a disk I/O at one time or another. Each disk I/O includes a seek, rotational latency, and disk transfer. If you use larger transfer sizes, this causes less disk I/O. That means less drive and seek and rotation. You still have the sum total of all the data transfers, but you avoid additional drive overhead. The other thing this avoids is subsystem I/O overhead. You may recall that a typical I/O has about 2.2 milliseconds of subsystem overhead to initiate and terminate. You can avoid this if you use larger transfer sizes, because less I/O also incurs less subsystem overhead. One more thing to keep in mind is that transfer size is always a compromise. Random workloads will suffer if you use a very large transfer size, because each I/O would potentially transfer more data than needed to satisfy the random I/O. You seldom have a single subsystem dedicated to one workload or the other, so choose this carefully. Transfer speed. If you're transferring a megabyte of data, this can take anywhere from 5 down to 2.5 milliseconds of time to transfer for a 2 to 4 gig and 4 gigabyte per second fiber channel link, respectively. SAS/SATA takes anywhere from 3.3 to 6.7 milliseconds. iSCSI takes even longer, about 10 milliseconds to transfer a megabyte long block. Transfer times are for both the back-end and the front-end transfers, although most subsystems nowadays start transferring data to the front as soon as the first byte comes in from the back. Some subsystems have mismatched back-end and front-ends, such as a SATA back-end operating at 1.5 gigabits per second and a front-end fiber channel operating at 2 gigabits per second. There's not much difference here, but your performance is impacted by the slowest link in the chain. Most disk subsystems provide sequential read-ahead, which attempts to detect sequentiality and move data into cache before it's needed. Some systems have a static value for this amount of data to be read ahead, such as read 3 blocks ahead. Another subsystem calculates this value in real time to optimize overall I/O workload. If your subsystem has a fixed read-ahead value, you can either let it default or play with this and observe performance results for your workload. Using a large value will generate great sequential response time, but other workloads may suffer, as consuming more cache for sequential workloads leaves less for others to deal with. The other cache value, which is sometimes fixed, is the read-to-write partition. Recall that writes are typically first brought into cache and then destaged out to disks. Some subsystems dedicate a portion of cache to only hold write data. This is called the write cache partition. The boundary between read and write partitions can be fixed or variable. If fixed, you can let it default to specify another size for this parameter. As a start, you may use the percentage of data written versus read. In any case, monitor your subsystem performance to see if destaging is slowing you down, and then adjust accordingly. Most mid-range or lower subsystems support cache mirroring of write data. This is where two subsystems are connected and backs up each other by mirroring write data from one subsystem to the other subsystem's cache. This does an extra I/O for each write operation to move the data into the other controller's cache. Write mirroring only applies to mid-range and entry-class subsystems because enterprise subsystems have multiple controllers within one subsystem sharing one cache already. If you wish, you can disable cache mirroring, but then you are exposed to loss of cache write data in the event of a power failure. You should balance your I/O across controllers, RAID groups, and LUNs. This means if one LUN is hot, you should try to pair it with cold LUNs or leave it alone and move other LUNs to another RAID group. We have already discussed LUN striping, but if unavailable, you can have the same effect by splitting up a hot LUN into two or more LUNs, dividing the workload. Just make sure the new LUNs are split across distinct RAID groups. Workload mix is another thing to consider. We have already mentioned that read ahead can consume cache space. Ordinarily, sequential and random miss workloads don't play well together in the same subsystem unless it's fairly sophisticated. The subsystem must limit the random while maintaining or expanding the sequential consumption of cache to provide for an optimum hit rate. It's a precarious balance and depends a lot on the ability of the subsystem to detect sequentiality and random miss workloads and act accordingly. You can avoid this by controlling your workload mix and only hit the subsystem with workloads that work well together. This is a trial and error proposition. Heavy sequential workloads should be paired with high random hit workloads to take best advantage of cache. All sequential or all random is at the extremes, but judicious combinations should work well enough together. A point-in-time copy sets up an association between one range of storage and another, wherein all updates to one are duplicated to the other. For point-in-time copies, most subsystems nowadays use a form of virtualization with copy-on-write technology, which copies the old block of data prior to it being overwritten and keeps two copies of the block for each update. Depending on the subsystem implementation, this can take extra cache, extra disk, and or other resources to do, and must be taken into account when configuring a subsystem and analyzing a workload. Optimally, you would schedule point-in-time copies to be done when there is little update going on. Also, you should terminate the point-in-time copy as soon as possible after the need has gone. There are a number of issues that can limit subsystem performance. Recall that backends are fiber channel, parallel SCSI, or SAS/SATA. Fiber channel backends can be switched or arbitrated loop. A fiber channel arbitrated loop has all the drives on a loop sharing a single fiber channel link bandwidth. So if you have 2 gigabit per second fiber channel arbitrated loop, this only supports 2 simultaneous fast disk transfers as fast drives transfer data at 95 megabytes per second. For slow speed devices, you could probably support 3 simultaneous transfers at once. These, of course, are simultaneous transfers, and one reason for a drive buffer is to hold data while waiting for a transfer slot to open up. This may not be much of a problem for occasional disk transfers, but if you have a large transfer size with a heavy miss or D-stage workload, this can be a serious limitation. This, of course, only applies to back-end cache miss and or D-stage I.O. Some subsystems support switch fiber channel backends, which allows each drive its own full 2 gigabits per second transfer rate. SAS/SATA technology is a point-to-point technology allowing each drive the full bandwidth of the serial link as well. Parallel SCSI is configured as a chain of drives or a loop. Drives are another limiting factor. This only applies to miss and D-stage activity, but nonetheless, there is an absolute limit to the number of IOs possible based solely on the number and speed of your disk drives. It's easy to calculate. Take the average seek, rotational latency, and transfer time, and you have a duration for the average I.O. For a fast disk transferring 64K blocks, this would be approximately 6 milliseconds. Divide this into 1,000, the number of milliseconds per second, and you have the max number of I.O.s a single drive can support. For a fast disk drive, this would be about 167 I.O.s per second on average. Doing the same exercise for a slow disk, you find that one slow disk can support about 77 I.O.s per second. Multiply this number times the number of active disk drives you have in the back, and you have a back-end I/O speed limit. Let's say you have 30 active slow drives in your back-end. You have a subsystem that can handle 2,300 read misses or D-stages a second. Whether this is a problem for you is a factor of your missed D-stage rates, as well as your peak and average workloads. Your front-end channels have an upper limit to the amount of data they can transfer, and you should be aware of it. Fiber channel can sustain approximately 90% of peak transfer rates across a single fiber. That means for a 2 gigabit per second fiber channel link, it should be able to sustain approximately 1.8 gigabits per second, or roughly 180 megabytes per second. Typically, you would need at least 2 to support any sort of redundancy and availability for the system, but these may not suffice if your workload requires more than this. iSCSI has a similar limitation, although it appears to only support anywhere from 50 to 80% of peak transfer rates. So 1 gigabit per second iSCSI link can provide anywhere from 50 to 80 megabytes per second of sustained data transfer. Now, 2 would be a normal configuration and would supply anywhere from 100 to 160 megabytes per second. This may not suffice for your workload and needs to be considered when configuring your system. Well, that concludes our third podcast in the series. For more information, check out the presentations on searchstorage.com or on our website, www.silvertonconsulting.com. The next podcast concludes our series and is on performance monitoring, when to make performance choices, benchmarks, and some final thoughts. For now, this is Ray Lucchese, President of Silver Consulting, signing off.
Great. Thanks, Ray. As Ray mentioned, be sure to check out other performance resources at searchstorage.com/performance. There you'll find the companion slides and more information about storage performance. Also, Ray will be presenting at Storage Decisions. If you'd like to see the full Storage Decisions program, head over to storagedecisions.com. That is a free conference for those of you who qualify. We look forward to seeing you at the offline events and the online events here on Search Storage. Thanks, and have a good day.